Hello and welcome. Welcome to the Dr. Lake Show. Thank you for all being here. It's been a while since I've been doing a show, so I'm really pleased to be here after a small break. And today I'm very much looking forward to this show because we're talking about something that is very relevant. This is a particular diagnosis that is, I think, discussed and in the media and been discussed historically quite a bit. I'm happy to have I think this might be our third time meeting, perhaps, with Dr. Arthur Burrows, friend, colleague, a clinical psychologist, and someone who's had currently in private practice, works much with private and first responders, but also has quite a lengthy history working in education and with children and families. I think prior to even being a psychologist, then you, of course, transferred some of those talents and skills into the field of psychology. So happy to have you back, Arthur.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
As am I. And, the diagnosis that you and I have talked about that we want to discuss today is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. But that's something you've done a lot of work with, is ADHD. So I'm wondering if you could at least give us a start with understanding, what is that diagnosis referring to?
Sure. Well, ADHD, or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, is a current name we have for to describe a constellation of difficulties that often occur together that impacts certain people's functioning. And it essentially describes a disorder where the individual has difficulties maintaining attention, can have difficulties with hyperactivity, restlessness, and can exhibit difficulties sort of with impulsive behaviors. Now, these don't always occur, all of them together, although there's a minimum sort of threshold to have the diagnosis. So it's a diagnosis that's made based on behavior, which is one of the difficulties of it, and we'll probably talk a bit about that further. But right now, we're looking at problems with inattention, possibly hyperactivity, but not always, and impulsiveness.
Okay. What is the actual prevalence? Do you have an idea of what that is right now?
Yeah, estimates range from, there have been many studies of this, both in North America and in Europe. And the incident range is somewhere from between 3 to 7% globally, or at least certainly, I should say, in Western countries. That in Canada, that would translate to approximately 2.5 million Canadians who are believed to be diagnosed with ADHD.
You know, it's interesting. That's quite a large, at least from my perspective, and some of the issues that I'm interested in, because or how ADHD is assessed in the population and how accurate it is. When we even look at prevalence rates, I'm always curious. I actually ran into a situation recently where someone was diagnosed with ADHD, but there was a whole host of other issues that were not acknowledged at all as a clinical presentation, other than ADHD. And I've also had clients themselves, individuals that I run into that may have another host of issues, and they wonder if they have ADHD. So what is your experience of diagnosing ADHD in terms of some of the issues that you run into?
Sure. Well, you touch on something that is quite well known in recent studies, as far as adults are concerned, approximately, one study I recently heard quoted was 87% of adults diagnosed with ADHD have at least one other diagnosable disorder, and 56% had two. So what we call that comorbidity, where you have two distinct disorders. And it's a good question, because quite often a lot of those disorders have similar behavioral outcomes as ADHD as a diagnosis. And this is one of the areas where we get, where there's a lot of debate, and I think well-earned debate on it. You know, are all our diagnoses of ADHD truly ADHD, or are they actually the behavioral symptoms related to other difficulties, either psychiatric or mental health difficulties or even medical difficulties as well. Mm. Such.
Yeah. So this is the area in which I'm interested, because I find there's sometimes motives that people have in wanting this diagnosis. And, you know, and even if there's overlay of other issues present that I witness in these different populations, whether it's a parent or a teacher or an individual themselves that questions if they have ADHD, that seems to be the question that pops up to explain all the symptoms mm-hmm. of ADHD. But my concern about that is it actually ADHD, or is it really a representation, as you said, of this overlay of this other conditions that are present? That would be one question. And then second, why is there this desire? I don't know if you observe it as a desire that people have to want to go to that label rather than taking into consideration other issues present. And that could be in children or adults.
Mm-hmm.
Big question.
Again, a very good question. I mean, there certainly are a range of motivations to seek a diagnosis of any kind of difficulty in the schools. Apparently, approximately 50% of childhood referrals for psychiatric assessment or for treatment tend to involve ADHD. So we're talking a substantial, I believe the single largest sort of identified disorder when kids get referred for psychological psychiatric services. So in the school systems, a diagnosis of ADHD will typically trigger at least some level of specialized support and services and resources, and typically, depending what jurisdiction you are, ADHD gets placed into different sort of special ed funding categories, but typically it's one of the behavioral categories. So, you know, the motivation there would be to provide services to a kid who's struggling, and that's fine, assuming they need that support. And
so is it considered a learning disorder?
It's independent of a learning disorder. Okay. And although it's a problematic diagnosis, and this is coming from somebody who really does believe that there is a core of individuals who suffer from something that, you know, would most of us would agree would be called ADHD, but you know, there is some indication and research that I did a while back suggested, and others have done as well, is there is some processing deficits that are similar to learning disorders as well. So, and certainly it impacts kids' learning, and their functioning at school. Yeah. So not just behaviorally, which it tends to be, we tend to think of ADHD as more of a behavioral problem. And there we're probably talking more about the hyperactivity, the impulsivity, as opposed to the inattention. But the inattention actually, I mean, those other two, but as well as the attention, impacts a child's functioning at school for sure.
What complicates the assessment of this diagnosis? What specifically, for example, conditions might look like ADHD that we have to take into account?
Sure. Well, again, the list, particularly with children, is almost anything else, and
anxiety, depression,
exposure to trauma, certainly brain injury or post-concussion syndrome, chronic pain, as we mentioned, all the other anxieties, sleep difficulties, so sleep disturbances, sleep apnea, and depression, obsessive compulsive disorder, autism, fetal alcohol syndrome, basically anything that troubles kids can impact on their ability to sustain attention, will impact their activity level, and quite often with children, you'll see increased activity as opposed to a drop down where that would be more common with adults, and certainly impulsivity. So it really, With ADHD, the way I like to, I think a fair number of those of us who specialize in that area and the diagnostic end of it, it's probably more a matter of ruling out everything else first, and that therefore makes it quite important to really have a firm history of the individual, and across different environments and different times. And from different sources to be able to kind of really identify how long have these symptoms existed and what other things have happened in the child's life both medically, psychologically, socially, family, so on.
So for if you were to give any recommendations, let's say to parents, who observe a behavioral problem and assume potentially ADHD. Mm-hmm. The issue I understand that is sometimes people question is around giving medication to young children in this particular case. But if you were to give a recommendation, let's say a parent approaches you and they say, I'd like to see if my child has ADHD, what do you think would it be important for them to know so that they can perhaps think about what kind of questions they're asking about their child that would be beneficial?
Sure. Well, whenever you get an assessment, and this is certainly something those of us who do these assessments like to hear is, what are you going to use this assessment for? What's the perceived goal of this? Is it just out of curiosity, which I do get particularly from adults. They'll come and, I've always struggled with these problems. Somebody told me I have ADHD. I'd like to find that out. And, we prefer, I would prefer to ask the question a little differently instead of go straight to the diagnosis. Just what are the problems that are really impacting the individual that they would like to have an understanding of? So, what are the sort of things that are forming barriers to that person being able to learn and function in their environment? So that's probably one of the first things I would ask them. What's making life difficult for the kid or the adult? So
so many people nowadays are doing their own diagnosis online. They go online, they say, I think I have ADHD, and I think that contributes to that misunderstanding, because they're assuming that because they meet all that criteria, that means they would have ADHD. What they really need to understand is that needs to be differentiated from other conditions. And in order to accurately diagnose it and treat it, perhaps, mm-hmm. that those other issues need to be ensure that they are not playing into that diagnosis, that they're not the main contributors to that diagnosis.
From my perspective, yes, because there, if quite often in children, one of the motivators is to be able to start stimulant medication, or there's a range of medications for ADHD. And maybe because I'm a psychologist and that's not in Canada our area of practice, I'm always a bit hesitant to jump right onto the medication route. Although before we start putting children on medication, you really want to understand, is the child's difficulties with attention and sustaining attention, is that due to, difficulties with ADHD, or is it because they have an auditory processing deficit? And when the teacher talks, they're really not able to process what the teacher's saying, so they're drifting off. And certainly, I've seen that often. So auditory processing deficit, but not really I don't believe official diagnosis out of the DSM, but it is one of the more common causes of reading disorders and so on. So, and I'll often see kids, particularly young kids, with a initial diagnosis from their pediatrician with ADHD, because everybody's told the physician that this child has a hard time paying attention, but we step back and we take a look at where they're having problems with attention, we discover there's another factor there. So like a learning disability. So
now ADHD is not exactly my specialty. It's certainly something I did in the past for a short period, but I'm just curious, when we look at trauma, we know, for example, that attention and concentration, and actually when I look at most of the conditions, we have issues with attention and concentration. Right now, there's a plethora of research out there on meditation and, the role of, standing, sitting in a place, in breathing and staying focused and allowing thoughts to come and go. And one of the things that they talk about a lot with the impact of meditation is that it helps with focus and concentration and impulsivity. Mm-hmm. Is that considered in AD? I don't know this at all, but is it considered in ADHD intervention above and beyond meditation? Has that been researched?
It has been researched, and it's evidence that it is quite helpful for kids with the diagnosis of ADHD. So it actually is. I don't think I see it very often being part of a child's treatment plan, certainly in the school settings, but that's perhaps understandable. I'm sure there are examples of it out there, but I think there is increased awareness of it. And it makes sense because, meditation does tend to improve, I think, attention for for most people. So it's going to probably help with it. ADHD may be different, but it's not that different.
So, right. Is it discussed much, or is it kind of more peripheral, the research on meditation?
At this stage, I think it's still pretty much on the edges of it. That's a good question. And I suppose the fact that I can't comment on it maybe is an indication that many of us haven't really looked at it yet.
It's something that I'm curious about. And obviously, I know you even went recently to do a training, and that wasn't brought up as a comment, and which I just find interesting because of just how much research is out there. I just think it would be something, an alternative to medication would be an interesting concept, to consider, right?
Yeah, probably medication is sort of particularly from the school's perspectives and the medical perspective, it's the chief, I would have, my impression is it's the chief intervention. But really my clinical experience and my experience in working in school systems, and I'll draw, I spent a total of 6 years working in a program here in Canada, in a school for children with learning disabilities and or ADHD. And in that program, a fair number of our kids came in on medication, and we typically at the beginning, start of the program, would take them off the medication. The vast majority were taken off. And my experience that the 5-6 years I was in that program was most of the kids did not go back on. So I think one of the central things is medication in some instances is helpful. And it certainly has been shown to provide a short-term improvement, so I'm not anti-medication in the least, but I am very much against medication is the only intervention. And because it, in the end, you know, ADHD, how I conceptualize it, this brain difference is something that's going to be with somebody for the rest of their life in one form or another. Symptoms tend to moderate, and you know, certainly the obvious bouncing off the wall hyperactivity tends to kind of evolve into more fidgetiness and restlessness and so on. But you know, as with all of us, we all, you know, it benefits us all to learn how to live with our brains and the kind of person we are, and to sell our, you know, find out what our strengths are and to really take full advantage of it, and then find ways to mitigate the areas we're weak. And that's especially true with when you have ADHD. So, you know, in school settings and home settings, or any setting, you know, there's modifications you can make to the environment to address certain behaviors and minimize the impact of those behaviors or lack of behaviors. There's also skills one can learn. The kids with ADHD, for instance, and it's not sort of a diagnostic criteria, but it's something that's pretty universal for people with ADHD who have what I would call sort of that brain difference, that ADHD brain. Organization is a weakness. So, but when you teach somebody with ADHD organizational structures and scaffolds to help them, you know, learn that writing an essay actually there's a formula for it. You know, all essays can be kind of formalized there. They have certain parts that you just have to put things into. And once a child with ADHD or an adult with ADHD learns that, that can make a huge difference. As a matter of fact, when you take a look at adults who are high functioning ADHD, so they have ADHD, but they've managed to go on and survive as an adult and flourish, they will often seem very, very, at least in some environments, very organized. Mm-hmm. Now, their house may be an absolute mess, and you know, if my wife is listening, she would
agree,
nod her head. But other aspects of mine are very organized, even though that did not come naturally to me, you know, and this is the important thing. With ADHD as well as learning disabilities, probably any disorder, you know, but certainly with ADHD and learning disabilities, even though you may not naturally be good at something, you can learn how to become good at it.
I'm definitely curious about. I mean, we talked earlier. I even thought, did I have ADHD? I'm multitasker, not finishing objects, not finishing things right away. I did start meditation at a young age. When I was 19, I did it for about a year. It exponentially altered my focus. And I don't know if those things can make a difference. And because I still think we're living in a society that seeks medication as a first route, and people who are struggling, and if they have other conditions, it may be comforting them to think that there's a medication that can help them with concentration and that. But I do find that if we were to pursue, you know, medication and meditation is interesting, but if we were to pursue that, you know, maybe there could be another approach to looking at improving our ability to stay focused and practice impulse control. But the difference is it's much longer term. And when I do work with my own clients and myself and do meditation, I find it's not an immediate gain. Your brain changes happens with considerable time. So, mm-hmm. and that seems to be where we go today in our society, because our performance is so conditional on having these abilities that sometimes there's an urgency to get that change.
Yeah, and sometimes we really, you know, for children, and when you're talking children in schools, you sometimes have to take a look what are the resources available at the school and the level of expertise. And you know, as much as you know, I can come in and you know, make recommendations to a classroom how it could be restructured to be more ADHD friendly. And I might add, in a way that will not harm kids who aren't ADHD and will probably benefit a lot of other kids who aren't ADHD. You know, it comes down to is there the capacity within the school to do that? And there you really truly move. It's not just a money issue. It's capacity and training and a understanding of what it means. For instance, a common reason kids will be referred for assessment in schools with the suspicion of ADHD is that Johnny's getting out of his seat and touching all the other students around and talking to them and everything else. And assuming that Johnny really truly does have that neurological ADHD brain, which I might add has some benefits too, but not typically in a classroom. Johnny just needs to be taught. So he may, and the research does suggest, and again, not just with ADHD kids, but Johnny may need to move around. And it's interesting in the hundreds, thousands of hours, maybe, of observing children in classrooms, what I often find is that Johnny is wandering around and appearing not to be paying attention, but every so often he'll contribute. He'll say something, maybe blurting it out inappropriately, but he'll say something that proves he's been following the whole conversation all the time he's been playing with the chalkboard in the back. Yeah. But he can be taught how to move around in a way that doesn't disrupt others. And really, that's the issue. It's not he's moving around. It's that his moving around which he neurologically needs to activate his brain. His moving around is disturbing others. We just teach him and organize the classroom a little different so that his moving around happens in a place that doesn't disrupt the other learners.
Do you think our expectations of children in any way, I can't compare children to animals and dogs and whatnot, but you look at attentional issues at a young age. Do you think our standards, our expectations are high of children to expect them to be able to sit down for a full day at school? What are your thoughts about that? Maybe I don't work with children. So what are your thoughts about that?
Well, sometimes I do think we sort of have expectations that aren't really supported by the child's developmental age and so on. The definition, for instance, of hyperactivity, what constitutes hyperactivity and in a lot of the measures that we use to diagnose ADHD, we give rating scales to the adults, so the parents and the teachers, and in there are items that kind of are meant to describe hyperactivity. And, it's always sometimes really interesting is when none of the adults can agree, it seems. And that could be because truly the activity level differs from school to home, which can happen, definitely. But sometimes it's one person's extreme, designation of a child being extremely motor active compared to another adult's idea of what extreme motor active for that age can be substantially different. You can have some families that are quite active, quite hands-on and just very active, very loud. And then they go into a classroom where the teacher is used to order and structure and things being still and quiet voices and so on. Right there, that teacher's probably going to perceive the child's normal behavior as being hyperactive, but in the context of his family system, it's not, So is that a brain difference or is that being raised differently? Right. Now, having said that, ADHD is genetically it seems to have a strong genetic tie to it. So, typically, if the child's ADHD, you can quite often find ADHD-like behaviors in the adults before them. So,
It's, I think there's hopefully going to be a continued evolution of our understanding of ADHD and maybe even with time, a greater ability to be precise in our ability to diagnose it accurately so that we don't over inflate the prevalence of it to the exclusion of considering other conditions, right, that might be present.
Yeah.
What could you, before we close off, I'm curious, what are some of the benefits of having ADHD? You just kind of alluded to it a minute ago, but what have you found?
Well, they're wide and they're varied. And I was writing them down just before for this because I thought in my business, so often we spend so much time talking about what's wrong as opposed to what's beautiful about it. And again, the reason, because we don't spend a lot of time researching what's good, right? So this is, a lot of people with ADHD are really good at spotting things they're not looking for. So you can't find your keys when you're looking for them, but boy, you'll be the first one to spot that $20 lying in the grass as you're walking by it and so on.
Yes.
And so typically real sense for the bizarre, which is one of the tricks when you're working with them, is to have a good sense of the bizarre, which a colleague of mine used to talk about all the time.
Interesting.
And a real capacity to be able to take unrelated things and bring them together. So a very different way of thinking. They're not that organized sequential way. It's more a random form of thinking
Very creative.
Typically, interestingly enough, although they're often described as being behaviorally as being insensitive to others because they're not picking up subtle sort of behavioral cues, like they're not always aware how they're coming across. They are also tend to be very, very sensitive and really wonderful with others who are underdogs and quite compassionate.
Should talk more about those qualities, right? Because I think it's important to see how those individual differences might be create and use those strengths to aid them in their life, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And really in the end for all of us, it's not our weaknesses that get us through life, it's our strengths. So
I'll go
back to it for anybody. It's understand the things, your weaknesses, the barriers you have, and find ways around it, but really find ways of taking full advantage of being able to express where your strengths are. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Well, I think this is all good information. I hope we continue to talk about ADHD and that maybe alternative interventions can be continued to be looked at. What would be a final thought you'd like to share with people about ADHD that people to think about when they're looking into that?
Yeah, well, certainly, the diagnosis, they'll if they go online, they'll get lots of conflicting information, and this is really because it is a difficult diagnosis to make. Primarily, to make a good diagnosis, you need to really rule out a lot of other things before, and ADHD is almost the last option, having ruled out stuff. It's not a diagnosis that can be made in 15 minutes,
right.
in my opinion, and I know that's shared by a number of us.
Yes.
So
yes.
I get very concerned when that happens, because you really do need, to make the diagnosis, you have to have information from multiple sources, and it needs to be across time and environments as well. So
yes. Yeah. And to be inclusive and look at more than just one condition, because I certainly see that as being an issue. And people have varying levels of exposure and experience in testing for ADHD. It's easy to pick up a questionnaire and to just fill it out and then do a diagnosis. But it is actually more complicated than that.
It is much more complicated than that. Yes. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Dr. Burrows. This is great information. Hopefully the listeners can get a little bit of insight and a little more clarity for themselves on what they want to be asking when they're going to see a clinician and get this diagnosis for themselves or family members. And hopefully we'll have you again and talk more. I know I love having these conversations with you.
Yeah, I would love to be back.
Wonderful. So take good care. Yes. And stay on the line, and I'll talk to you in a minute. And I want to thank listeners for tuning in to the show. Again, I'm hoping to be back soon enough. There have been a few changes happening, so most likely I will be back within a week, and then with another little break. Hoping to continue more regularly within time. But thank you for tuning in. I wish you all the best, and take good care.